At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What does it tell you when a 300-point drop on the Dow is no big deal? Well, it tells you a couple of things. That other places are worse off than we are. That maybe it's time to start thinking about problems in the real economy, not the 30 stocks in the Dow. And maybe that 300 points down wasn't enough. We'll explain that last one in just a second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 24th of October, Friday. Good to have you with us. And you didn't have to look too far to see the fallout from the financial crisis. Today, it was spread all over Wall Street and the global economy. We'll take a random walk to figure out what happened. There was other big picture news, too. OPEC is going to pump less oil, but you'd never know it to look at prices. And suddenly, the IMF is the most popular kid on the global economic block. So, listen, I have to tell you, I thought we were in for another one of those 700-point down jobbies today when the opening bell rang. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has been watching the markets for us in New York. And, Jeremy, we have to start before the open here, I guess, and explain what happened overseas, don't we?
That's right. There were already fears of a global recession, but there were a couple of particularly frightening pieces of data that emerged overnight. In South Korea, growth hit a four-year low. There were fears that exports in Asia would be affected. The Nikkei in Japan falls by 9.5%. Then in the UK, there's word that the economy shrunk for the first time in 16 years. The FTSE in London falls by 5%. Then here in the U.S., there are layoff announcements, more of them. Goldman Sachs, Chrysler, Xerox, all saying they're going to cut thousands of workers from their roles. Now, take that all into account in the midst of the general fear that's been here for several weeks, and you get what happened today, because in these times of fear, these little pieces of information take on a much greater significance than they ordinarily would.
Talk to me about that fear for a second. Is it fear of what's going on in the equities markets, which is to say volatility and general unknown, or is it fear about the larger economy?
Well, certainly fear of what's going on in the equities markets is ratcheting this whole thing up a bit. And since the financial crisis started, that fear has been much higher than it was before. But investors I talked to today said people are starting to get the letters about how their mutual funds are performing. Investors are starting to pull out of these mutual funds. Investors are pulling out of hedge funds. That means these funds have to come up with capital, which means they've got to sell other investments. And that underlying mechanism of the market is also driving things down.
One of the things that happened overnight before the open here was the Dow futures, that is to say bets on which way the Dow is going to open, were pegged down. That is, they were down 550 points and they had to stop trading in those. What does that mean and why is it important?
Well, that's a big deal because it's the first time it's happened since 1997 in the Asian financial crisis. Back then, it happened twice, once when the Dow was down 350 points and later as it fell by 550. Of course, 350 at this point would be like a nice day at the beach. But the investors I spoke with said that the fact that it didn't reach those circuit breakers, as they're called today, means that there's going to be fear that it's going to do it next week. And we stay in this climate of fear.
You mean they wanted a bigger loss today?
Yeah, well, you know, President Bush famously said that Wall Street got drunk. Well, my source, I hate to use this analogy, but said that they're trying to throw up right now. And basically, until they do, they're going to be sort of moping around the apartment trying to find the way to the bathroom.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson with a vision of the markets for us that I don't know if we're ready for. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kai.
On a day like today, with the world coming to terms with a severe economic slump, you'd expect oil prices to drop. The theory is there'd be much less demand for crude as growth slows. And indeed, oil prices did fall today, $3.50 down to $64.15 a barrel. But today's cheaper oil was counterintuitive in at least one respect, because OPEC ministers announced a hefty cut in production this morning, 1.5 million barrels a day. And they promised to cut output even more if prices keep on dropping. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now on why OPEC's move didn't matter much.
OPEC will cut 1.5 million barrels of output a day by December. But OPEC already exceeds its current quotas by 300,000 barrels a day, and Tom Wallen with the Energy Intelligence Group says OPEC has a credibility problem.
They can come out with a pronouncement of a production cut, but the big question is, are they going to deliver on it? Because they have a track record of not living up to these things 100%.
OPEC resisted calls from its own members to cut even more on fears that could really trim demand. Oil prices are now 60% below their highs, and that's helping U.S. consumers cope with tight credit and lower home values. But when the economy comes back, Stephen Lieb, the author of The Oil Factor, says the price of oil will be explosive.
Then it's a boomerang. It's not just that it'll go up. It'll go up probably about as fast as it went down and very likely exceed previous highs.
That's because falling oil prices now are forcing energy companies to curtail exploration for new sources. And when demand picks back up, supply will be scarce. But in the meantime, the Department of Transportation says Americans drove 78 billion miles less in the first 10 months of the year compared to last. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's not just developed economies that are getting tripped up by the global slowdown. The International Monetary Fund is in talks with a couple of countries that desperately need loans to keep their economies from hitting the rocks. Pakistan, Hungary, Iceland, and Ukraine are among the countries officially in discussions with the IMF. But plenty of others are feeling the pain, too, including relative success stories in the developing world, like Turkey and Brazil. As Ashley Montite reports, their problem is us.
Until last year, there was plenty of money flowing into emerging markets from wealthy nations. Francisco Larios is chief emerging markets economist at Decision Economics.
Investments in things such as infrastructure spending, factories, as well as a number of financial instruments.
But as economic problems hit the U.S. and Europe, investors are pulling their money out of developing countries and putting it into U.S. treasuries or cash. Larios says it's partly an increased aversion to risk thanks to the economic turbulence in the West. But also, he says, investors recognize that the rich world's ill fortune will affect the poorer countries.
The U.S. and Europe will be buying less from the rest of the world than they were buying a year or 2 years ago.
Stock markets in developing countries have fallen sharply. Suddenly, there's far less money to keep things running. So many countries are applying to the IMF for loans. The fund says it has more than $200 billion at hand. James Barth of the Milken Institute says it's in the economic interests of the U.S. and other wealthy countries that the IMF obliges. Fast.
If the United States wants to export goods and services to other countries, it obviously needs those countries to be in pretty good financial condition to be able to actually purchase those goods.
If emerging market economies founder, Barth says, it'll only worsen the recession in the rich world. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the major indices wrapped up their fourth down week out of the last five. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has been a week of what? The immediate bailout crisis has passed. Credit markets are slowly getting better. Equity markets, stocks, well, they've had their ups and downs and downs. What we haven't heard much of, at least in substance, until this week is homeowners. Now, all of a sudden, Congress is talking about them. The head of the FDIC is talking about them. And we are going to talk about them with some people who've been here before. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, David Leonhardt at The New York Times. Hello to you both.
Hi, Kai.
Hello.
Lee, let me start with you. Have we now turned a corner to where we're not so much worrying about Wall Street? Maybe what we're focusing on now is the mortgage industry and homeowners?
Absolutely. I think in the past week, we've really seen concern and panic turn from, you know, the rescue plan for the financial system to sort of greater problems that are looming for the economy as a whole, things that $250 billion injected into the banks is maybe not going to help. And housing is certainly one of those things.
David Leonhard, I have to ask you, though, how do you do this? Because if everybody out there gets help on their mortgage, I want some.
Exactly. And that's really the problem here. We can do more than we've been doing with helping people stay in their homes, and I hope we do, but we can't solve the foreclosure problem. And if we suddenly try to save all of those people, one, it's not clear that that's fair and that we shouldn't be using that money to help unemployed people, for instance, maybe who rent. But the question is, how much would it cost to essentially prevent the rise in foreclosures that is coming? And the answer is it would cost an enormous amount of money because we would not only have to save all the people who really would lose their homes over the next year, but because it's very difficult to distinguish among those who would and those who wouldn't right now, we would also have to save a lot of people who wouldn't.
Lee, is spending that money worth it, though, do you think?
Well, I think that's a huge question, and I think that strikes right to the point. I mean, more than 2 years after the problems began happening with mortgages, the fact that, we are still struggling over how to fix these loans just reflects the complexity of the situation and just the way that, these mortgages were really, you know, just spread out and sliced and resold. It's just, it's not that easy. I do agree with David. I mean, you can't. Saving everyone would be just a staggering sum of money. There's lots of different proposals out there right now, and I think there has to be, I mean, we have to do something.
One nice way to look at it is that we should be doing more than we've done so far, but this is not a magic bullet.
Do I hear you saying then that perhaps that's not where the focus needs to be at this point in macroeconomic time?
I think that's where part of the focus needs to be, but I think it would be a mistake if that's where we've shifted all of our attention. You can help the economy in other ways. You can help the economy by extending unemployment insurance. You can help the economy by starting projects, for example, fixing highways and bridges. You can help the economy by sending people tax rebates. And housing should be part of all that. But it's not clear that it should be the only thing, and it certainly is not the case that the only way to help Main Street is to help homeowners who are in trouble.
Lee, pick up on what David was saying there about infrastructure and other kinds of public spending and the prospect of a new stimulus plan. It's not going to be, here's $600 for every taxpayer in this country, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, this proposed plan doesn't have tax rebates at its center, and this is, you know, more focused on creating jobs, investing in spending, building our infrastructure and things like that. And those things are very, very important. I do think, though, that housing has to be a part of this as well. And that really, I mean, housing is really at the root of this crisis and really the root from which all the other problems flow. I mean, the borrowers defaulting is what caused the institutional problems in the first place. So to not attack the borrower side at all was probably a little bit myopic. And I think that's what a lot of the talk was about this week.
David, you're there in Washington. Is it your sense that this stimulus package is going to happen sooner rather than later?
Well, obviously, the politics here are unusual in that we are less than 2 weeks away from a presidential election and a third of the Senate standing for election and the entire House. So I think we're unlikely to get anything done until the election happens. Once the election happens, who knows what will happen? I think if John McCain wins, that means there's less reason for the Democrats to delay. If Obama wins, then I think they may pass something and essentially say to President Bush, sign this if you like it, and if you don't, we'll wait.
David Leonhard at the New York Times, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thank you both so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Now, let's do the numbers. After another stomach churner, the Dow Industrials finished the day down almost 3 2/3%, 312 points to close at 8,378. The NASDAQ traded down 3 1/4%, 51 points, ended at 1552. The S&P 500 came to rest almost 3.5% lower, that is 31 points, finished at 876. For the week,
Deep breaths now, everybody. The Dow sheared off 5.4%. The NASDAQ unloaded 9.3%. The S&P 500 forfeited 6.8%. Fears of that global recession everybody's talking about ruled all week. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase lost 6.3%. Goldman Sachs spun off 7.5%. Shares in National City lost 1/4 of their value. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by the Medtronic Foundation, letting listeners know that October is Sudden Cardiac Arrest Awareness Month. More about SCA risks and treatment at hearthelp.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Monday. The Federal Reserve begins the commercial paper funding facility. It allows highly rated companies to tap the government for loans. Project Vote Smart concludes its national tour in Washington, D.C. And in 1964, future President Ronald Reagan launched his political career by delivering his famous speech, A Time for Choosing. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, in reality, today's market turmoil has been going on for the better part of 24 hours now, because, as we all know, just because the closing bell rings on Wall Street doesn't mean trading actually stops. There are after-hours sessions, then Asia opens up with a Nikkei loss 9.6% last night. As those markets are hitting their stride, Europe gets going. London was one of the hardest hit. The FTSE index of the top 100 British shares ended the day down 5% on the nose. The British pound tumbled too. It fell to a 6-year low against the dollar. And today's GDP figures did nothing to lift the gloom, the first decline in British GDP in 16 years. Even the government admits a recession in the UK is on the way. And some economists say it could be the deepest in the Western world, more severe than any downturn here. Scary as that thought may be. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
This is the Four Crosses pub just north of Birmingham. A few weeks ago, it was dying on its feet, barely a handful of customers every lunchtime. Then the pub introduced the Credit Crunch menu.
One liver and onion, two fish and chips, and one minced beef pie.
Every full, steaming hot plate of food costs just £1. That's about $1.60.
We needed a promotion of some sort, so we decided to just try £1 menus just to get people in.
It's been a spectacular success for the pub manager, Tony Rabbits. Now every day, more than 600 people turn up for lunch and dinner.
Well, it's very good value for money.
Money's tight at the moment, so, yeah, definitely.
I think we're all feeling the pinch. Jobs are a great worry with people at the moment. But I think the whole nation will be feeling the effect of this global recession.
And Britain will feel the effects worse than any other leading industrial nation. That's the view of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. It's forecast that the British economy will shrink next year by 1%. Director Martin Wheel says that's the biggest anticipated fall in output for any G7 country, including the United States.
Yes, in the United States we're expecting a fall of output of 0.5%, which of course is still a recession. It's just not as bad as that in Britain.
Why? Because Britain has been on an even bigger binge than America.
The British economy has been keener on credit and household debt even than the United States, so therefore we're even more affected when credit markets jam up and people can't borrow.
Wouldn't it be nice if good things didn't have to end? With Vantage on your current account from Lloyds TSB.
The extent to which the Brits have been lured into debt is amazing. Americans have borrowed $1.35 for every $1 of household income, but the Brits have borrowed $1.70. This massive over-indebtedness is mostly due to a particularly British obsession.
Hello and welcome to Property Ladder, the show that follows first-time developers as they turn hard work into hard cash and property into profit.
Fueled partly by TV shows like this and by dreams of instant wealth, the Brits borrowed and bought property like crazy. House prices in overcrowded Britain soared. While they doubled in the US, they tripled here. And so, says property economist Ed Stansfield, the UK's heading for a much bigger crash.
Now that the credit crunch is upon us and banks are falling over themselves not to lend rather than to lend, we think the absolute least you can expect in the UK is a decline of around about 35% from peak to trough in average house prices.
He says it'll be the biggest national house price collapse on record, impoverishing millions of once smug homeowners and crushing consumer confidence. The Brits will have learnt the painful truth of that old American adage, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right, can I have one fish, one cottage pie and one cheesecake for dessert, please?
But there's always pie and chips for a pound at the Four Crosses pub. The manager is happy. He says his booze sales are up fivefold since he introduced the credit crunch menu. Many similar promotions are expected around Britain in the months ahead. This is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Twenty years ago today, the Dow closed at 2170. The blue chips didn't really do much of anything that day, fell 13 points. Crude oil was about $15 a barrel. Groovy Kind of Love, covered by Phil Collins, topped the pop charts. And only 18% of businesses were owned by women. Congress wanted to better the odds for female entrepreneurs. So on this day, back in 1988, it passed the Women's Business Ownership Act. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports now on what's happened in the past 20 years.
If you walked into the average startup incubator back in 1988, less than one in five of the businesses there would have had a woman owner. 20 years on, that's more than double, to 40%. Wilma Goldstein of the Small Business Administration ran the Women's Business Ownership Office until last year. She says the act helped increase the number and diversity of women-owned businesses.
There used to be this thought that women started service-oriented businesses, making things at home and selling them. In the last 10 or 15 years or so, there is no area that is untouched by women, from running DNA businesses to IT companies to these peculiar things that only engineers understand.
Goldstein says the act also made it easier for women to get credit. It stopped banks from asking about marital status or requiring a male relative to co-sign a business loan. Margaret Barton heads the National Women's Business Council. She says these days women entrepreneurs can get loans as easily as men, but she says women tend to be more risk-averse and less tied into established financial networks.
Women are more likely to go to their own credit cards, their family, their houses to find the seed money to start their own businesses.
That can limit their ability to grow, she says, but that doesn't mean that female entrepreneurs feel disadvantaged. Julie Doria is an entrepreneur in Portland. She runs a co-working facility where people set up temporary office space. She doesn't see much difference between herself and male entrepreneurs in terms of the desire to make money or grow. The difference, she says, is in the way women view other entrepreneurs.
Women tend to be more supportive around each other versus competitive when they're sharing and hashing out business ideas, I've found.
Some women are plenty competitive when it comes to looking at the rules that govern federal contracts. They complain that less than 5% go to women-owned businesses. They say raising that number would go a long way to increasing the success of female-owned businesses. But at the SBA, Wilma Goldstein says new legislation to level the playing field isn't likely in the short term. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Bush administration announced some good news out of Afghanistan today. The White House said opium and poppy production there has fallen almost 30%. The plant and the drug have long been the largest parts of the Afghan economy, and the U.S. and its allies have been trying to change that for years. Many Afghans, of course, have other things on their minds. 5 years ago, the government made a surprise announcement. Many of its precious antiquities, some dating back to 2200 B.C., were intact. That is, not destroyed or stolen. No mean feat, considering the country has endured a Soviet invasion, warlords, Taliban rule, and now the U.S.-led war on terror. Today, some of those artifacts go on display in San Francisco. But Gregory Warner reports the collection is only a fraction of the treasure still underground in Afghanistan and unprotected.
About 15 years ago, a young Afghan named Reza Husseini saw a movie.
I'm going after a find of incredible historical significance. You're talking about the boogeyman.
Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Besides, you know what a cautious fellow I am.
For American audiences, it was just a fun flick. For Reza, the movie was an epiphany. His own ancient heritage was being stolen, dug up, and sold on the black market. So Reza got inspired to teach himself all about ancient Afghan archaeology.
Unfortunately, the people of Afghanistan now forgot their story.
Reza's 26. He's returned to Afghanistan, where we met, by accident, near a mosque that he admired. I didn't even have my usual recording kit with me, so I used the microphone on my camera.
One, two, three, four. You can see?
He showed me the mosque from the early years of the Islamic invasion, a mosque with Buddhist designs.
And you can see that? A flower? That's a lotus flower. It's a Buddhist symbol.
Today, Reza carries around a camera, and he documents what he loves before it disappears. Without a car or even a bicycle, he'll walk, sometimes through minefields, to look in on historical sites. Most of the sites he won't show me, for fear if a foreigner goes there, then people will know how valuable it is. It's an old lesson in Afghanistan. If you want to save something, hide it.
I remember many journalists ask about this.
18 years ago, a young museum director named Omar Masoudi risked his life to conceal thousands of Bronze Age objects in a secret chamber under the presidential palace. While warlords battled in the streets, he told everyone he'd lost the goods.
Yeah, our answer was always, we don't have any information.
Now the treasures that Masoudi helped save are on a U.S. tour. National Geographic paid $1 million for the loan of the artifacts. The Afghan government will spend most of that money renovating the Kabul Museum to keep them safe. Syed Jawad is Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States. He admits an equivalent treasure from Egypt might have commanded more.
Keep in mind that the name of the Egypt is right away associated with tourism. What is the name of Afghanistan associated with today? So it's a different objective that we are bringing these items. We want to make sure that people see the true Afghanistan.
The risk is that once we see it, we'll want to get some of it for our living rooms. And as long as Afghanistan's artifacts remain unprotected, that collector's desire might just raise the market price. In Afghanistan, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes to send you into your weekend. First, an update to a story we did this week about banks using bailout money to get bigger. When we told you about it on Tuesday, it was just a possibility, something being talked about out there. Not anymore. This morning, PNC Financial announced it's buying National City with the help of a $7.7 billion loan from the bailout fund. Maybe this will make you feel better, though. A rare burst of chocolate chip goodness in the middle of the meltdown on Wall Street. Mrs. Fields, the cookie company, announced today it's coming out of bankruptcy. It was a brief stay in Chapter 11, 2 months exactly. Enjoy that, some of their chocolate chippers, and a nice glass of warm milk tonight. And we'll do it all again on Monday, because that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday. Today, the Dow rolled down 312 points, 3.5%. The NASDAQ lost 51 points, 3.25%. The S&P 500 fell 31 points, 3.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. There is more of Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis, this weekend on Marketplace Money. And coming up here on Marketplace on Monday, turning the Bible into a coffee table book.
People say, can you do this with the Bible? Can you handle a Bible like that? That's a holy book. Well, if it's so important, read it and let it be out there.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.